Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On the evening of February 26th, 17-year-old Trayvon Martin bought a pack of Skittles and a can of iced tea from a convenience store in the Orlando, Florida suburb of Sanford. On his way back to his dad's girlfriend's house, he was shot and killed by 38-year-old George Zimmerman. Zimmerman called 911 to report a, quote, suspicious guy after seeing Trayvon, an unarmed black teenager, walking down the street. He said, quote, "This guy looks like he's up to no good or he's on drugs or something. It's raining and he's just walking around looking about." Zimmerman admitted to police that he shot Martin in the chest, but he still has not been charged. Over the past week, this murder has received international attention. So on today's Your Call, we're opening the lines to get your thoughts and feelings on this issue. What do you think of this case? What do you think of the stand your ground, shoot first laws passing across the country? How are you talking to the young people in your life about this, especially young people of color? And what does justice in a case like this really look like? Thousands of people took to the streets to talk about all of these issues last night in New York City and in Oakland and San Francisco. Trayvon Martin's parents were at the rally in New York City. His parents were also on an MSNBC's Politics Nation show last night, and we want to play a clip from his mother. This is Sabrina Fulton.
Yes, my heart is hardened right now. I'm finding it difficult to do just daily things right now. In addition to grieving, I'm just consumed with the fact that this guy has not been arrested who murdered my son. So that is very difficult for me as a mother. I cry every day. There is a hole in my heart because that was my baby. Regardless how old he gets, he was my baby. So it's difficult for me on a daily basis, but I'm just trying to take one day at a time.
And that is Sabrina Fulton, Trayvon Martin's mother, speaking on MSNBC's Politics Nation last night. She and Trayvon's father were at the rally in New York, Tracy Martin, and they're expected to also be at another rally tonight in Sanford, Florida. So we want to open the lines today and get your reaction to this case. What are you thinking about right now? How are you talking to young people about this? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or drop us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. What do you think is the most effective response here? Today we're joined by Susan Jacobson. She's a breaking news reporter for the Orlando Sentinel, where she covers police and court news and consumer fraud. She's been covering this case from the very beginning, and she joins us from Orlando. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. We're also joined by Joshua Bloom. He's coordinator of the Ella Baker Center's Heal the Streets Youth Fellowship Program. The youth he works with are the same age as Trayvon, and they have voiced outrage and pain over what has happened. And Joshua joins us from Oakland. Hi, Joshua. Thanks for the thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And in about 15 or so minutes, we'll be joined by Colin Goddard. He's Assistant Director of Legislative Affairs for the Brady Center to Prevent Violence. And he'll be talking with us about these shoot first laws. Colin actually survived the 2007 shooting on the Virginia Tech campus that left 32 people dead. He was shot four times. So, Susan, let's start off with you. The question that everyone is asking, Trayvon's parents talked about this last night on MSNBC. Why hasn't George Zimmerman been arrested? Why is he still walking free?
Well, the police say they don't have enough evidence. And one of the reasons is a 2005 law passed in Florida called Stand Your Ground. And it allows deadly force if a person believes that the force is necessary to prevent his or her imminent death or great bodily harm to himself or someone else. There's no duty to retreat anymore as there was previously.
And so this law was passed in Florida in 2005 under then-Governor Jeb Bush.
Correct.
And can you talk a little bit more about this? Because, frankly, I didn't really even know about these laws until this case broke. And they're passing across the country.
I think a lot of people didn't know. There have been a few cases that didn't get a lot of media attention, but then this one, of course, has captured everyone's heart. And this was passed largely with the pushing of the National Rifle Association, and the legislators, I guess, thought it was a good idea because we also have the Castle Doctrine here, as do many other states, which says you can also shoot to kill in your own home if someone breaks in and you feel threatened.
Mother Jones reports that the law makes it much more difficult to charge shooters with a crime and has regularly confounded juries in murder cases. Many Orlando area cops reportedly have given up investigating, quote, self-defense cases as a result, referring them to the overloaded state attorney's office for action. What else can you tell us about this? The Tampa Bay Times in 2010 did a study and found that, quote, justifiable homicides had tripled in the state since the law went into effect in 2005.
That's a very interesting statistic. I do know that there have been more cases, and they've included people who were unarmed, as Trayvon Martin was, who have been killed, and then the killers have not been prosecuted. In this case, the police didn't make an arrest because they were consulting with the state attorney's office, who told them, you don't have a case, not even for manslaughter with this law.
And we'll be talking more in detail about these stand your ground, shoot first laws in just a couple minutes. I also wanted to ask you about something I've been hearing repeated in most media reports. They're calling George Zimmerman a neighborhood watchman. But ABC News ran a piece called FBI Justice Department to Investigate Trayvon Martin Killing. And they quote Chris Tutko. He's the director of the National Neighborhood Watch Program. He says there are about 22,000 registered watch groups nationwide, and Zimmerman was not part of a registered group, another fact the police were not aware of at the time of the murder. So what are your thoughts on this? Is George Zimmerman a neighborhood watchman? Is that accurate?
He is. In fact, there has been a lot of conflicting reporting, but I spoke to Mr. Tutko and to the Stanford police this morning. The group is not registered nationally, but there is no requirement to register. And really the only advantage is you have access to training materials and they know you're out there so they can tell other people, hey, I want to start a group in Sanford. They can say, there's already a group in Sanford. The group is definitely registered with the police department. It started last September. And George Zimmerman is in fact the coordinator. He runs the program.
Hmm. And what else can you tell us about what you're finding about George Zimmerman and the phone calls he's made to 911 just this year and his past record?
Well, there have been numerous calls, and it's hard to know what was justified and what wasn't. He has often reported suspicious people. I believe I have the statistics somewhere here, but I think it was 46 times that he had called for help. It's hard to make a judgment about whether that's too much. We do know that he very much wanted to be a police officer. He had said that in applications for citizen academies and such. And sometimes if you have a policing group that is actually run by the department, the police department, they will try to ferret out that type of a person because they don't want, as they call it, cop wannabes. That said, prior to this, nobody had complained about George Zimmerman.
And that is Susan Jacobson. She's a breaking news reporter with the Orlando Sentinel. And Josh, you're a coordinator with the Ella Baker Center's Heal the Streets Youth Fellowship Program. Obviously, the facts are so crucial in this case, and we'll be talking about those on the show. But we wanted to bring you on to find out how you're talking to the youth that you work with about this case. What are the youth, how are they reacting to this?
I'm getting a varied response from young people. What's happening is certain young people, I think, are kind of numb to situations like this. We experience violence in our communities every day in Oakland, with 103 homicides last year and 24 already this year. So, I mean, if you don't give young people the space to process a situation like Trayvon Martin, then it becomes just another homicide across the country. What I'm finding out in talking with our young people last night, especially, is once they understand the full details of the whole case, they're outraged. The fact that the Stand Your Ground law actually exists, a lot of young people are not even aware of in Oakland.
Right. I don't think a lot of people around the country were actually aware of these laws until this case broke. And now they're on the books in 17 states, including Alabama, Arizona, Georgia, Washington, and New Hampshire.
Right. And especially right in our own backyard with the Oscar Grant trial, national case as well, understanding that they feel as though the lives of young people are essentially worthless. I mean, if you look at a situation like Oscar Grant here in Oakland, which now has been almost 4 years, you see that, police were essentially murdered this man and then arrested his friends and then were celebrating and cheering in front of them in jail cells. This was brought up by somebody who was a family member of somebody who was arrested the night Oscar Grant was murdered. So it's just the quality of life for our young people here in Oakland. And once they hear about this situation with Trayvon Martin, it's easily relatable for them.
Well, now I'd like to welcome Colin Goddard to the show. Colin is Assistant Director of Legislative Affairs for the Brady Center to Prevent Violence. Colin has worked tirelessly for gun control since he survived the 2007 shooting on the Virginia Tech campus that left 32 people dead. And Colin was shot that day 4 times. Hi, Colin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Colin, what are your thoughts on, I mean, there's so much to talk about with this case, but specifically these shoot first laws, they've now been getting a lot of attention. Why are they passing so quickly around the country? And what concerns you most about this?
Well, that's a good question. I think first, what concerns me about the law is just the bad policy in the first place. And, coupled with that is also the mentality that the policy then gives to people that allows them to, in effect, shoot and kill somebody for any sort of perceived threat anywhere they are. And in this case here, you had a man who instigated a situation on another younger individual, an unarmed individual, and is now able to claim self-defense somehow and avoid prosecution from the law. And he's using the shoot first, ask questions later law as his defense. I think it's unbelievable.
How? What are you seeing in other states? Because we have some statistics in Florida about justifiable homicides tripling in the state since the law went into effect. Are you seeing similar percentages in other states where this law is on the books?
We have seen an increase in justifiable homicides. You're right. And Florida is the kind of laboratory for kind of policies like this for the National Rifle Association. And, you know, Florida was the first one to allow people to carry loaded concealed weapons around in public. And they're also one of the first states to allow this the shoot first, ask questions later law. And then many other states have adopted it. So Florida is kind of the NRA's utopia for laws that they want. And they create a situation like we're seeing now with Trayvon Martin, where the shooter, the murderer, is not being prosecuted.
Two state legislators who sponsored Florida's Stand Your Ground law in 2005 called for George Zimmerman to be arrested for shooting Trayvon Martin. A Republican former Senator Durrell Peden told the Miami Herald, quote, they got the goods on him. They need to prosecute whoever shot the kid. We've got full lines, so let's take a few calls and then we'll get responses from our guests. Let's hear from Tanya in San Leandro. Hi, Tanya. Welcome to the show.
Hello, hi.
Hi.
I really have a lot of problems with the Stand Your Ground law. It seems to me that these laws are basically written just to give people license to kill. We're seeing that crime is down around the country, yet these laws are being passed. And, you know, I think about a kid like Trayvon Martin who's literally minding his own business and can just be shot, can be chased down and shot in the street like an animal because this guy, obviously, it seems to me Zimmerman probably knew about the Stand Your Ground law and knew he could do it. So, you know, what's going to happen and what's happening to try to change these laws? You know, it's hard enough to be a black, you know, young black man walking around minding your own business as it is, but, you know, now we've got this law to contend with, you know, and it's even more dangerous, clearly. So I'd like to hear more about, you know, what kind of actions are being taken to, you know, are there actions, or has everyone just given up on trying to fight the NRA, you know?
Well, thank you for that. And I actually found that, according to Mother Jones, there are now 24 states with these Stand Your Ground laws. And they also say that a number of states are considering these laws, including California. I didn't realize that was the case. Colin, what are your thoughts on this? Are there a lot of community groups that are trying to prevent these laws where they're not in place, and what can people do where they are in place?
Absolutely. Like I said, like you said, there are, I think we have 21 states that currently have this law on the books, and I think about six or seven others that are currently in their legislative sessions with the bill somewhere along in the process. I believe in Indiana, this bill is on Governor Daniels' desk waiting for a signature. But in other states like California, we have a lot of activists and motivated people who work on common sense gun reform, gun violence prevention issues. So, you know, I doubt this will become law in California, but in other places where, you know, we're looking and trying to continue to build our advocacy. Unfortunately, the National Rifle Association is just a group that is allowed to go to these state legislatures and stand up at committee and say the NRA supports this bill or the NRA does not support this bill and sit back down, and that's it.
Susan, what does it look like on the ground in Orlando? How are community groups now dealing with the Stand Your Ground law?
People are outraged. They've actually had to move. Al Sharpton is coming tonight, and they've had to move a demonstration to a larger venue, a large park, because they're expecting thousands of people. And I believe that pressure has caused legislators to rethink this. There's been a call, notably Corinne Brown, who's a Jacksonville representative, U.S. rep, is talking about wanting to get this thing repealed. But we'll see if the momentum continues.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, Tanya. Let's hear next from Phyllis in Oakland. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi, good morning. You know, what disturbs me is that no one is putting any emphasis on the fact that this man chased down this child, provoked this aggravated assault, and then shot him. There's a timeline from the convenience store to the point of death that's from the store. There has to be a camera recording. So the time between when he left the store and got shot is minimal. Why is no one putting any emphasis on the provocation?
Well, thank you for that. Susan, can you comment on that and give us some information about Trayvon's conversation with his girlfriend? She spoke to authorities about what happened right before he was shot.
Correct. Well, she's actually given a sworn statement to lawyers for Trayvon's family stating that he thought someone was following him. He was going to put his hoodie up and walk faster. So we can gather what we can from it. The problem and why the Stand Your Ground law has resulted in few prosecutions is because we only have the word of the person who's alive. Mm. And George Zimmerman said Trayvon was the aggressor. And there was actually, the police said, some evidence to support that. They had gotten into some sort of fist fight, and that George Zimmerman had blood on the back of his head, and I think his nose was bloodied as well.
His girlfriend, Trayvon's girlfriend, said he told her, quote, "Oh, he's right behind me. He's right behind me again. Right. Why are you following me?" Another man asked, "What are you doing here?" And, you know, I didn't realize this until I heard the parents on MSNBC's show last night, but his father, Tracy Martin, said he had to contact the police first and file a missing persons report. So his argument is that the cops took Zimmerman at his word and didn't bother to knock on any of the doors in this gated community to say, do any of you know this kid who was just shot?
That is an interesting question, but what you said is true. He went to the morgue, medical examiner's office, and was later identified. He did not live there. He lives in Miami and was visiting.
Right. His girlfriend? Father's girlfriend?
Yes. I believe, yes.
And also, there was a cell phone. The authorities had a cell phone, but they didn't use it to call anyone on the phone.
There has been a lot of criticism of their investigation. Of course, they steadfastly say, you know, there was no race involved here. We did a great investigation, and we've sent it to the state attorney. Unfortunately, we're getting bits and pieces and not every official document. So I'm hoping more will come out. I think we're all hoping so that we can have a better picture. But certainly, there have been doubts cast on how effective the investigation was. And in fact, there's a call, by the way, last night for the police chief to the city commission is pressuring the police chief to resign.
They took a vote of no confidence?
Correct.
Colin, that's part of the problem with these Stand Your Ground laws. It's just so bizarre because the other party can't speak for himself if he was killed.
Right, indeed. And, you know, not only that, I mean, I think I heard a law enforcement officer from that precinct, I believe, say that, you know, if we begin prosecution of Mr. Zimmerman, that opens us up to lawsuits and litigation because of the shoot first law that allows people to defend themselves. Litigation that has come in the past and could quite come from groups like the National Rifle Association claiming that that's unconstitutional and not possible. So, you know, they're trying to do what they can, the police department, within the confines of the law that's been modified for them over the years. And it puts them in a very tough position, and it's making them look horrible. And, you know, I believe that there are many problems with that investigation, and you can see that the citizens of that community are outraged.
Well, we've got a number of other calls, so let's hear from, thank you, Phyllis. Let's hear from TJ in Sunnyvale. Hi, TJ. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I'm actually someone who supports the stand your ground type law here, but think it's really a stretch in this instance. And I wanted to mention, since you mentioned the Tampa Bay article on the history of this law in Florida, that was in response or as part of a series on a shooting in Tampa involving a man named Trevor Dooley, an elderly black man, who took his gun out in his HOA to confront a teen who was skateboarding. This other fellow, this white fellow, set upon him to try to take away the gun, and the gun went off. That's the best story. Somehow, the attorneys have decided to charge Mr. Dooley with manslaughter in that instance. And yet in this instance, as another caller mentioned, we have this 911 record of this fellow Zimmerman chasing down poor Mr. Martin and effectively shooting him. And how is it possible that we can't charge Zimmerman with manslaughter, at least, when we can do so with Mr. Dooley?
Hmm. Well, and also, I'd love to ask you, TJ, because Colin is going to leave us in about 15 or so minutes, and he's the expert on the Stand Your Ground, Shoot First laws. Why do you support these laws?
Because, frankly, the police can't be everywhere. And we have a Second Amendment that says, you know, we have the right to keep and bear arms, and we have the right to protect ourselves. You know, I shouldn't have to retreat if some drunk asshole, is coming at me.
What are your thoughts about having people like a George Zimmerman walking around neighborhoods with guns looking for, quote, suspicious people?
That's just the opposite. You're not standing your ground. You're setting something off.
Colin, what do you think about TJ's response and why he supports these laws?
Well, I honestly asked him to reconsider, and it's scary that literally just as this Trayvon Martin case was blowing up in the national media, you had the NRA introduce a bill in Congress here in D.C. to allow people with concealed carry permits, people like Mr. Zimmerman, who still has his permit, by the way, to carry that gun in every other state in this country. Even if the requirements are different, even if the standards are different, they're trying to nationalize this whole thing when you can see how dangerous it is. Mentality being put across every single state in this country is even Times Square in New York, where law enforcement have nothing to say or to stop the person. It's unbelievable. You know, these are not good public policies. These are market expansion policies. The NRA would like a gun in every person's hand, being allowed to be carried everywhere and being used at any time. And that's not good public policy. That allows them to sell more guns to more people.
Well, thank you for calling, TJ. We'd get his response, but he just clicked off. Colin, you have to leave us in about 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now would be a good time. If you want to talk specifically about the Stand Your Ground, Shoot First laws, that's where Colin really focuses his energy, and he's an expert on this. So now would be a good time to call about that at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We also want to talk about how you're speaking with children about this, especially children of color. We'll speak with Joshua Bloom after the break about that. And then if you have any overall questions about the case, we've got Susan Jacobson here. She's a reporter with the Orlando Sentinel. So we really wanted to open the phone lines today, get your reaction to what is taking place. What does justice look like? How do we create communities that are safe for the next Trayvon Martin? 866-798-8255. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
You are listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco, and if you have not visited KALW.org lately, it's changed a lot. The redesign is aimed at making it easier for you to find the information that you want and for you to be able to share the programming you value on KALW with people that you know. However, it's still a work in progress, and we need your help to make it better. So check out the new KALW.org, see what you think, and send us any suggestions you have for improvements. And thank you for listening to and supporting your local public radio station, KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll discuss coverage of the This American Life retraction of its show about Mike Daisey's Apple and Foxconn monologue. We will also mark the 9th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, which got very little attention this week. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the killing of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin, which happened on the evening of February 26th in the Orlando, Florida suburb of Sanford. It took a couple of weeks before the national media really started focusing on this. And this week, it's really exploded. In fact, the international media are now talking about this case. George Zimmerman, the alleged killer, has not been charged. So we're talking about why that is. We're talking about these stand your ground, shoot first laws, which have been implemented in 21 states. There's a bunch of different numbers going out there, but according to the Brady Center to Prevent Violence, it's 21 states. So what are your thoughts on this? What does justice mean in this situation? How are you talking to children? How should we be talking about, especially children of color, about this issue? We've got full lines now. We'll have a few open in just a couple of minutes. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. We're joined today by Susan Jacobson. She's a reporter with the Orlando Sentinel. She's been covering this from the beginning. Joshua Bloom is coordinator with the Ella Baker Center's Heal the Streets Youth Fellowship Program. He works with kids who are the same age as 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. And Colin Goddard is assistant director of legislative affairs for the Brady Center to Prevent Violence. He is a survivor of the 2007 shooting on the Virginia Tech campus that left 32 people dead. And Colin was shot four times. Now, before we get back to calls, Joshua, how do you talk with kids about guns? Because as you said, there are 24 homicides this year in Oakland. And so here are these shoot first laws being passed across the country. And then people are calling on the students or the kids of Oakland to give up their guns. So how do you have a conversation about guns in this climate with young people?
It's really difficult. Our young people come from environments where these forms of oppression and racism, economic oppression, environmental oppression are internalized and kind of released to these forms of violence in their communities. And so all day our young people are struggling to navigate the violence that's happening all around them. So I think that the real issue here is around what's causing people to pick up these guns and commit these acts of violence. Young people in our community experiences all day, and so it's easy for them to relate to a story like George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin. Just with one of our young people having been harassed consistently by a policeman on her block and having to deal with that every day. So it's really a question of perpetual stress that these young people go through, not post-traumatic like a soldier would go through, but perpetual. And so opening those spaces and having those conversations honestly and authentically with them that they do not have in their schools and at their homes and in their communities.
And what would you add to that, Colin? At the Brady Center, how do you talk to young people about this, especially young people who live in communities where there are 103 homicides in one year?
That's a very good question. I think the previous statement is I would totally agree with it. You know, I view this, the problem of gun violence, the 100,000 Americans who are hit by a bullet every year, I view reducing that number in one of two ways, or both ways, actually. From the top down, the supply side, dealing with the easy accessibility to firearms in this country. I mean, Florida allows people to legally buy guns without even going through a background check. Mm-hmm. And allows people like Mr. Zimmerman, who's got a previous criminal history for, you know, resisting arrest of an officer, potential battery, to carry a loaded weapon around in public. So you have to deal with the easy accessibility, but then you also have to deal with the propensity for us to use a gun to solve our problems. And we do that at a rate higher than any other country in the modern world. And that's a fundamental problem, that you come from the bottom up. You have to give people another way, show people another way how to resolve their problem. Show people, you know, can't just say stop doing that, and, you know, and don't give them something else to do, another way to resolve conflict. So So you really have to come at it from both ways. And I think if we do that effectively, then we can see a serious reduction in the number of Americans shot and killed every year.
Well, we've got so many emails. I just want to read a few. Jack says, I have yet to hear the word stalking. The killer was stalking the kid like, quote, damned prey. The law gives the shooter the right to stalk the kid all over the neighborhood. You can bet that if the victim was white and from a Pacific Heights type place, the shooter would be awaiting trial. This shooting shows the mindset of Florida. What was the ground being stood on? Thank you for the email, Jack. We have another email from Jonathan. I don't understand how the stand your ground law is even part of this equation when there's evidence from the phone conversation between George Zimmerman and 911 where he is following Trayvon Martin. George Zimmerman pursued the child against the directions of the 911 representative and shot him. He did not stand his ground. We've got a number of emails like this, Susan, because the 911 tape has been played over and over in the media, and the dispatcher did say, do not follow him.
He said, we don't need you to do that. But a statement released by the city says that's a suggestion, it's not an order. Now, some people will say, so what? But he was told, you don't need to follow. And I believe he said he was not going to follow. And then something happened where the two of them got into this. I also wanted to make one other point. Zimmerman was arrested, but charges were dropped, and therefore there is no lawful reason, at least in Florida, that he cannot own have a concealed firearm.
So he was arrested, and according to Trayvon Martin's parents and their lawyer, there was no drug or alcohol test done. But you're talking about he was arrested previously.
Previously, I apologize. Yes, not he was not arrested in this case.
Not on the night.
Right, so he didn't have a criminal record per se.
So just visually, I'm trying to figure out what this looks like. The cops show up, Zimmerman admits that he shoots Trayvon, he's on the ground, and the cops just tell Zimmerman, you can go away with your gun? I just don't understand how that played out.
I think a lot of people obviously do not understand. The manslaughter law in Florida says the killing of a human being, manslaughter is the killing of a human being without lawful justification. And what the police, and to this point, the prosecutor has been saying is that, well, he says he was threatened under this law. It's justifiable. Understand your ground. Well, he did have justification. So it's now going to be reviewed by a grand jury, and the U.S. Department of Justice has been called in as well.
So as far as we know, George Zimmerman still has that gun, and is he able to leave the country and...
Well, it's a good question. Someone asked me yesterday in-house about this. I thought the gun had been confiscated, but I haven't been able to confirm that. But either way, he's definitely hiding is probably a little too strong, but maybe not. He's somewhere where he can't be found because he's gotten numerous death threats.
And has anyone been able to do an interview with him since this?
No, he's refused all interviews. And, in fact, his father briefly released a statement to us at the Orlando Sentinel, which said that his son had not followed Trayvon, and that... It appears that there's some conflict there in the facts, perhaps. And his father, in fact, has had to move out of his house, too, because of threats and harassment. So nobody's talked to them for a while.
That is Susan Jacobson. She is a reporter with the Orlando Sentinel. She's been covering this case from the very beginning. And Colin, we have a question I think you can answer from Rita. She says, what if my neighbor and I have a running dispute and I confront him in the neighborhood, shoot him, and claim that I feared he would harm me because of the dispute we had been having? Am I scot-free in Florida? I have the gun and he doesn't?
That's a very good question. And there's a couple other a couple other pieces to that. You need, if there was no other witness to be able to testify to something different, and you claimed self-defense in a state that has the shoot first, ask questions later law, we're in a very similar situation to the Martin family right now. When you allow people to carry loaded guns around in public and they're on their hips like this, when they deal with confrontation, that becomes a viable option. That becomes something that, can be used to resolve your conflict. And when that is the case, you have instances like this happening.
Well, thank you, Rita. That is such a very important question. And let's go to a few more calls before we have to let Colin go. Jason in Salinas. Hi, Jason. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you. Colin, my question is this. It seems to me that at face value, these stand your ground laws are actually unconstitutional based upon due process. Has there been any legal process or any legal pushback to say, wait a minute, at the point that somebody pulls the trigger and becomes the judge, jury, and executioner, the person they shoot doesn't get the due process that they're entitled to in the Constitution?
That's a very good point, and I believe our legal team is looking at that as we speak.
Is it safe to say that your legal team is trying to figure out all of these questions that we're having? Because now this is a national dialogue about these stand your ground, shoot first laws?
Absolutely. I mean, we are the one group that challenges groups like the National Rifle Association in court. And, you know, I'm happy to say that when we're in the realm of the legal realm of a courtroom, you know, we do much better compared to our political standing, where money is much more involved. In a courtroom, it's not the case. And when you're playing with the same rule book, we've done a lot better. So we're looking at all options here on every level to see what can be done so that similar situations like this don't happen again and aren't reoccurring in the future.
There have been a lot of reports about, obviously, the connections to the NRA, and I wanted to ask you, Media Matters is reporting that the legislation was adopted by the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, as model legislation. They got their information from the Center for Media and Democracy, which has been doing extensive reporting on ALEC, and they basically promote model legislation favorable to their corporate funders through state houses across the country. Do you know of any connections between these stand-your-ground laws and ALEC?
Not necessarily between Stand Your Ground laws and ALEC, but that doesn't really come as a surprise. Many of the other pieces of legislation that we combat in states do come from ALEC. I believe there's actually a congresswoman down in the state of Florida who forgot to remove the ALEC part from the bill before she introduced it. But, you know, like I said, it promotes the incentives of corporations and business owners, and like I said, these are not good public policies. These are good market expansion policies for the firearm industry.
We have a lot of questions about standing up to the NRA. Since you were shot in 2007, what has really stood out for you in terms of politicians that stand up or don't stand up to the NRA? What's really changed since that shooting?
God, that's a tough question that I don't really want to answer truthfully, because I don't think a lot has been done, and unfortunately, I can visit, you know, a number of offices up here in D.C. and in different states and tell them my story and tell them, look, you know, we need to be doing background checks, proper background checks on people. And they'll tell me, look, you know, I support you in this conversation, but please don't ask me to support this publicly until I have to with a vote, because otherwise I can't do it.
Mm. Do we know, is the NRA still one of the top lobbyists in D.C., and do you know how much they contribute to politicians across the country?
They are one of the top lobbyists in D.C., and like I said, I've seen their lobbyists in different state legislatures who just literally stand up in committee and say, the NRA supports this bill, and sits back down, and that's it.
Hmm. Well, we've got a number of more callers, and Colin, we'll let you go in just a couple minutes. Let's just take a few more calls. Heather in Alameda. Hi, Heather.
I had a couple things. If he didn't obey the police who suggested that he stop following, then he pursued on his own. He was countermanding the officers or the person on the phone's orders. I mean, here, if the policeman asks you to do something and you don't, then you are, you know, resisting arrest or whatever, not arrest, but, you know, you can get in a lot of trouble. So couldn't they get him at least on a minor thing? And if he is so paranoid that somebody walking down the street is considered suspicious, then he's a danger to other people, if not to himself, and couldn't they get him on psychiatric charges, especially if he has a history of doing things, which it seems like he does. And then if, you know, the state of Florida doesn't really care about human life, maybe they would care more about money. You know, if greed's the way to get them, then perhaps people should avoid going to Florida. I know a lot of people in Europe and other places in the world are afraid to come to the United States because of the amount of guns here and the amount of innocent people who are killed. Mm.
Well, and it's not just Florida. We're talking 21 states, Alabama, Arizona, Georgia, Washington, New Hampshire. Colin, final thoughts before we have to let you go.
You know, I feel for the Martin family. I cannot imagine what they're going through. I mean, I survived that, you know, that day. My family still has me, and not having a son like that is something that is just incomprehensible to me. I feel so happy for being able to talk about this now and engage a conversation with the general public about our laws and about what we're doing about public safety, and say, look, you know, this is happening to people on a daily basis. 32 Americans are murdered by a gun every single day. That's the Virginia Tech that happens every single day in this country.
Every single day, 32?
That's 32 murders. If you include accidental shootings and suicides on top of that, you're looking at more than 80 Americans killed by a gunfire every single day.
Mm. Well, Colin, thank you so much. You were featured in a documentary called Living for 32, and it's going to be featured in the Bay Area next month, and we're hoping to do a show on that, and we'd love to have you back.
That'd be great.
All right. Thank you so much. That's Colin Goddard. He's Assistant Director of Legislative Affairs for the Brady Center to Prevent Violence. Colin has worked tirelessly for gun control since he survived the 2007 shooting on the Virginia Tech campus that left 32 people dead. Colin was shot 4 times. And today we are talking about the shooting, killing of Trayvon Martin, 17-year-old. Unarmed black teenager who was buying a pack of Skittles and a can of iced tea from a convenience store in the Orlando, Florida suburb of Sanford on his way back to his dad's girlfriend's house. He was shot and killed by 38-year-old George Zimmerman. Zimmerman told police that he did, in fact, shoot Trayvon Martin. He still has not been charged. We've got about 10 minutes left with Susan Jacobson, a reporter with the Orlando Sentinel, and Joshua Bloom, coordinator of Ella Baker Center's Heal the Streets Youth Fellowship Program. And we'd love to hear from you. We've got full lines. A line will come be free in a couple minutes. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Heather and Alameda. Hi, Heather. Welcome to the show. Hi, Heather. Sorry about that. Let's go to Roger in San Francisco. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I think it's TJ, actually.
Oh, hi, TJ.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
I called earlier, and I guess thanks for putting me through again. And maybe there's not someone who can answer my question. You let me speak about the Stand Your Ground, but you know, Time Magazine has this report that the Tampa Bay paper did originally about Trevor Dooley, you know, in this case, a black man shooting a white man, and it seems in far more justifiable circumstances, in that he's been charged with manslaughter, and Zimmerman hasn't. And, you know, until I hear a good explanation of why, I'm just shocked, notwithstanding my support for Stand Your Ground. There's, you know, it's not applicable to everything.
Well, and I'm sure lawyers are looking into this very question. So thank you for calling in, and hopefully we can do another show on this because there are so many legal questions that seem to be unanswered at this point. Thank you for calling. Let's go next to Hill and Felton.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. There's one report I heard actually yesterday that Trayvon Martin was shot in the back. So that is not like if Zimmerman shot him in the back, then he wasn't being attacked by Trayvon Martin, was the idea I had. Also, I don't hear anything about any investigation of the body to see the positioning which would tell a lot and possibly give,
All right. Well, thank you, Hill. I think I got the gist of your question. Susan, what are the facts here? According to reports, Zimmerman told police he shot Martin in the chest.
Yes, and that is based on the documents we've reviewed. That seems to be true. Of course, everything has not been released, but that is what we've been reporting. What's happening is a lot of things are being picked up on Twitter and Facebook and so on, and they're spreading like wildfire. For example, there was a report out that he was shot 2 times. And when the gun was examined, he'd only been shot once, basically. And so, to the best of our knowledge, he was shot in the chest. But I'm aware that all of these things are going around. And the other problem is there's so little trust. Mm-hmm. Nobody believes what the police are saying.
And also, can you talk about what happened to Trayvon's body after the shooting? His father said in this MSNBC interview that they conducted a drug and alcohol test on Trayvon, but they didn't on George Zimmerman.
I don't think they did. I think you're correct. And, you know, in retrospect, did they handle it right? That remains to be seen, and now it's too late to do it. Based on what I know of the department and the history and everything, I honestly think they were perhaps a bit, you know, naive, had no clue at all that this was going to blow up like this. But in the context, people who don't know Sanford, there's a history here, and that's part of why this became so incendiary and was picked up all over the country. It's a relatively poor community. It's a diverse community. It's got some antique shops downtown, but there's a long history of mostly black workers being used for agriculture, celery, in fact. And there's been a lot of racial tension. Most recently, a white son of a police lieutenant in Sanford sucker punched, basically just cold cocked a black homeless man, and somebody caught it on video and put it on YouTube. And that led to the ouster of the previous police chief, who's been gone only about a year. So you can see where it's sort of an ongoing problem that people are very sensitive to.
Right. And Joshua, before we get to our next caller, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you, NPR ran a very powerful piece this morning about, quote, the talk that parents of color have to have with their children about everything from how to deal with, you know, going to the mall and maybe a security guard staring at you, to hanging out on a corner, to dealing with cops if you're pulled over. This is getting a lot more attention in the last couple of days.
Right. I think that's a very difficult talk to have with a young person. There's definitely a lot to be said around relationships with young people and police. There's definitely a push out here in Oakland to have more dialogue with young people and law enforcement, and talking to our youth about how to engage and how to react responsibly to make sure that they're not a target of profiling or suspicious racial profiling is a very difficult talk to have. It's very difficult when young people do not trust the surroundings and their community, the law enforcement, the people around them. So it's definitely a talk that needs to happen, and it's very difficult to have.
We have a couple Facebook comments from Samuel. My dad had the, quote, talk with me and my brothers back in the 80s. I will do the same for my son very soon. Duran says, my mom had the talk with me and my brothers when we reached pre-teen stage, and we all thought she was being paranoid until we each had our first encounters with racists and cops. We have to fight for a world where no parent has to give that talk to their child ever again. And thanks for those comments. Let's go to our next caller. Sergeant Chris Bolton is calling in from the Oakland Neighborhood Watch Program. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Welcome. Thanks for having me.
So there's so much to talk about here. Well, we're almost out of time. Can you first tell us, what is the Oakland Neighborhood Watch Program?
Neighborhood Watch is basically the foundation of our community policing model. It comes in a few different components. We have, at the block level, a Neighborhood Watch and Merchant Watch groups. And we move up to a neighborhood level with our Neighborhood Services Division, Neighborhood Services Coordinators, Neighborhood Crime Prevention Council. And then at the citywide level, we have a Public Safety Director in the Mayor's Office. We have, obviously, the Police Department working on, bilateral citywide initiatives to address crime.
And do you work with various groups? Are you working with the Ella Baker Center on this?
We have worked with the Ella Baker Center in the past. We recently, I just heard the tail end of your caller as far as our need to communicate with youth.
Right.
And we are very sensitive to that. We just recently met with Pueblo, and they have a program, Youth Policy Builders. And this is probably the last 60 days or so. We are interested in having a chief's advisory committee made up entirely of youth from different backgrounds here in our city.
And Joshua, what are your thoughts on the Oakland Neighborhood Watch program?
I think that it's definitely something, as these conversations are already developing and happening. We had one youth cop panel back in, I think it was November, at Mayor Kwan's Stop the Violence Summit. And I think that there's definitely some openness with the police department to have these conversations and to provoke dialogue with young people. Connecting with young people and allowing them to engage and feel safe in the process is really a big deal. And so as much as possible, having these conversations being youth-led and less intimidating for the young people who have to deal with this psychological trauma all day from police in their community.
Right, and we're getting a lot of emails from people whose parents who are concerned about their children. Chuck writes about his teenage daughter going to Florida next week for a spring break trip. He wonders if there are precautions for young women. What can we do here, Chris, to really create neighborhoods that are safe for children, especially the next Trayvon Martin?
Well, I think, again, getting back to, and I appreciate Joshua's past willingness, and then hopefully we can work together, because this neighborhood youth council is something that we do want to put together. But I think the basis of neighborhood watch groups is really building a stronger, better community that trusts the police, and the police need to trust the community to also share that information. So really, our neighborhood watch groups are focused on basic crime prevention tips, tips for preventing robbery, burglary, and various street narcotic level crimes. We do focus a little bit on self-prevention, but more importantly, what I want to put out is that we have a Neighborhood Watch Block Captain's Manual. We have training that all Neighborhood Watch organizers and participants participate in. And really, that's the necessity to report suspicious activity to the police. We do not promote people engaging with criminals and taking criminal problems on themselves.
And Chris, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're almost out of time. And Joshua, in 30 seconds, I was really struck by some photos from the rallies in New York and San Francisco. Young black kids had signs that said, "Am I next?" What do you say to them about creating a safe community, especially for youth of color?
It's such a difficult conversation to have with them. There are so many threats when they walk out the door, from the time they go to their school to the time that they leave the school, to wherever they go and where they head home, to their community. So it's a matter of really engaging them, like I said, in these dialogues to process the trauma that's happening to them on a daily basis, to give them the space to talk about it, and to really, really teach them to look out and be safe for possible threats from law enforcement or other violent acts in these communities.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. We will definitely continue this very important conversation. Joshua Bloom is coordinator of the Ella Baker Center's Heal the Streets Youth Fellowship Program. Susan Jacobson is a reporter with the Orlando Sentinel. And thank you so much for joining us and sharing all of this information. And Sergeant Chris Bolton with the Oakland Neighborhood Watch Program, thank you for calling in. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll have a conversation about media coverage of This American Life's retraction of its show about Mike Daisy's Apple/Foxconn monologue. We'll also mark the 9th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. We'll be joined by Mother Jones' Andy Kroll, The Atlantic's Rebecca Greenfield, and Al Jazeera's Jane Araf joins us from Baghdad. Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.